Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
We left off with Lee Harvey Oswald moving to New Orleans and working at the Riley Coffee Company. Like many other subjects in this case, there is evidence that Riley Coffee was connected to the CIA, but there's nothing tying Oswald to the CIA through Riley Coffee. So, like other disputed areas of this case, there's something for everyone. Lots of connections if you want to say that there's a conspiracy, but so far, no actual proof that those connections are tied to the assassination if you want to say that Oswald was a lone nut. In this episode, we look at Oswald's passport renewal in New Orleans, one that arguably should have been much more complicated for Oswald than it ended up being. We also look at the background of former high-level FBI agent turned private detective Guy Bannister, a man who Warren Report critics say knew and worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and was involved in the plot to kill President Kennedy.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. On June 24th, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald traveled about 3/4 of a mile from his job at Riley Coffee to the U.S. Passport Office on Loyola Avenue in New Orleans. He must have gone to the passport office sometime during business hours that day, but his time card shows that he worked from 8:57 until 5:30 p.m. at Riley Coffee. Now, Riley Coffee employees didn't clock out for lunch, so it's most likely that Oswald went to the passport office during his lunch break. Oswald needed a new passport because the one that he got back from the U.S. Embassy when he left the Soviet Union was good for travel to the United States only. Oswald didn't need a passport to go to Mexico, but once he made it to Mexico, he would need a passport to travel to any other country. So, theoretically, if Oswald did want to go to Cuba or the Soviet Union, or make it look like he wanted to, then he'd need a new passport without travel restrictions to be able to do that. Oswald's new restriction-free passport was issued on June 25th, the day after he applied for it. But given all of the actions taken by Oswald in the Soviet Union, it shouldn't have been so easy for him to get a new passport in just one day. If the appropriate State Department lookout cards were in place, then the process should have been slowed down or potentially resulted in Oswald being denied a passport. But that's not what happened because the lookout cards were not in Oswald's file. According to the Warren Report, quote, "Under the procedures in effect in 1960, a refusal sheet was prepared in the Department of State Passport Office whenever circumstances created the possibility that a prospective applicant would not be entitled to receive an American passport. The records section of the passport office, on the basis of the refusal sheets, would prepare what was known as a lookout card and file it in the lookout file in the passport office. Whenever anyone applied for a passport from any city in the world, his application was immediately forwarded to this office, and his name and date of birth checked against the lookout file. If a lookout card was found, appropriate action, including the possible refusal of a passport, was taken. In other words, the lookout card was a warning for the State Department to not provide routine approvals for special cases. The record is mixed on whether a lookout card was ever completed for Oswald, but we know that when he went to get a new passport in June of 1963, there was no lookout card in his file because he was granted the passport within 24 hours. In October of 1959, when Oswald attempted to defect, there was no refusal sheet filled out by the U.S. Embassy consuls due to an exercise of discretion on their part. As you may remember from the Oswald in Russia series of this podcast, the Moscow U.S. Embassy took the position that Oswald never actually defected because he didn't turn his passport in on a day the embassy was open, and because he didn't fill out the proper form. So there is a plausible reason why Oswald's attempted defection didn't result in a lookout card from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. On the other hand, on March 25th, 1960, after the U.S. Embassy had lost contact with Oswald and his mom told the State Department that she couldn't find him, a woman named Bernice Waterman in the passport office prepared a red refusal sheet for Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, this should have led to a lookout card being created, but the State Department says that no lookout card was ever, quote, prepared, modified, or removed from the file. Now, this is confusing because, as the Warren Report acknowledges, a March 28, 1960 memo from the State Department to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow says, quote, an appropriate notice has been placed in the lookout section of the passport office in the event that Mr. Oswald should apply for documentation at a post outside the Soviet Union. This memo is describing something that already happened. So where was the lookout card? Bernice Waterman from the passport office told the Warren Commission, quote, it looks to me as if someone started to handle this case for the refusal card, or lookout card as you call it. A new report had been received and our control clerk made that call slip for the file. Waterman explained that there were different protocols for classified files and regular files. She said, quote, we had been requested not to forward any kind of classified files to the usual place for having these cards made. We should forward them to the classified files section, which would take it up from there and give them to the proper person to have a card made. When she was asked about Oswald's lack of a lookout card after she had prepared the refusal sheet, Waterman said, quote, all I could say is it is very surprising. There's an internal State Department document, Commission Exhibit 983, which shows that the classified box was checked for Lee Harvey Oswald's file. This means that, according to Waterman, the file was sent to the classified file section. After it was sent to the classified file section, for whatever reason, no action was taken to make a lookout card. Waterman gave the Warren Commission a theory for why no lookout card was ever created. She said, quote, I can only guess that this file was caught up in some large number of files that were on hand to have refusal cards or lookout cards made, or something of that nature, or that the process of having the card made was interrupted by the receipt of the new material from our embassy in Moscow. In addition to Waterman's March of 1960 attempt to have a lookout card created, one also should have been made when Oswald obtained a travel loan from the State Department in June of 1962. Lookout cards were routinely prepared when these loans were given because the borrower is not allowed to travel abroad until the loan is fully repaid. The State Department told the Warren Commission that it should have prepared a lookout card when the loan was issued, but that the card was never prepared, probably due to a clerical error. Ultimately, there were three instances that should have triggered Oswald having a lookout card in his passport file, but all of them failed. The first one, as we've discussed, can potentially be explained by the U.S. Embassy in Moscow not deeming Oswald's defection as an official legal defection. The second one, triggered by Oswald's mom contacting the State Department looking for him, should have resulted in a lookout card because Bernice Waterman did create a refusal sheet. And the third lookout card should have been created routinely when the State Department travel loan was issued, but it wasn't due to a clerical error. On top of all of that, the Warren Report says that even if a lookout card had been prepared, it would have been removed and destroyed after it was determined that Oswald had not legally defected, and therefore, the failure to create a lookout card didn't really matter because it would have been removed from the file anyway. But that's not consistent with what Bernice Waterman, who wrote up the refusal sheet, said. According to a July 27, 1964 State Department memo, Waterman was, quote, only attempting to avoid the issuance of a passport routinely in the event Oswald should apply in the future. She added that she had not marked the refusal sheet disregard when it was decided that Oswald had not, in fact, repatriated himself because she considered the card a flag, which would avoid Oswald getting a routinely issued passport. Bernice Waterman's statement that she would not have removed the refusal sheet when Oswald was determined to have not legally defected is in direct conflict with the Warren Report's conclusion that the lookout card would have been removed anyway. Guy Bannister is one of the keys to solving the mystery of Lee Harvey Oswald's time in New Orleans. Depending on who you ask, he's either the most obvious connection point between Oswald and the intelligence community, or he's a misunderstood person who was accused of being linked to Oswald, but never had any kind of real relationship with him. Bannister began his career in naval intelligence during World War II. Then, after the war, he became a police officer before joining the FBI. After working in FBI offices in Montana, Oklahoma City, and Minneapolis, he eventually became the special agent in charge of the Chicago FBI office. The focus of Bannister's work with the FBI was spying on the activities of leftists. Here's how Bannister described it. Quote, "It was my duty to supervise the work of special agents. It was also my duty to develop and supervise those people commonly called informers. To be more specific, we might say that they were counter-spies sent in to report on the activities of Communist Party members. That was part of my duty throughout the 17 years that I served as special agent in charge." In 1954, Bannister retired from the FBI and moved to New Orleans, where he began working in internal affairs for the New Orleans Police Department. Bannister was fired from the New Orleans police in March of 1957 after pulling a gun on a bartender. That same year, Bannister opened his detective agency, Guy Bannister & Associates. But witnesses say that Bannister didn't really do any investigative work for the agency. Joe Oster, who was a friend of Bannister's from the New Orleans police, was one of Bannister's first employees at the detective agency. Oster eventually quit that job when he found himself doing most of the work and Bannister turning down lucrative investigations. Bannister was extremely anti-communist, which isn't surprising given his background of spying on communist sympathizers. In addition to the Friends of Democratic Cuba, which we'll discuss shortly, Bannister was also a member of the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean and was the president of the Anti-Communist Committee on the Americas Caribbean Division. Bannister also performed background checks on behalf of anti-Castro groups, specifically on students at Louisiana State University who wanted to become members of Sergio Arcacha Smith's anti-Castro group, the Cuban Revolutionary Council. Bannister also published the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which said that the civil rights movement was a communist front and that President Kennedy was a communist for supporting it. But the thing Bannister spent the most time doing was building his file system of perceived communist sympathizers in New Orleans. District Attorney Jim Garrison found an index to Bannister's filing system, which showed that Bannister was gathering intelligence on left-wingers, just as he had done throughout his entire career with the FBI. This revelation has to make you wonder why Bannister was doing this work. Was it just a hobby or what? According to Joe Oster, Bannister had the ability to easily get J. Edgar Hoover on the phone. The director of the FBI, who was Bannister's former boss, would sometimes speak to Bannister on the phone in his office. The FBI wasn't the only intelligence connection Bannister had. His former employee, Joe Newbro, said that Bannister was a conduit of funds for the CIA. Joe Oster also says that he heard phone calls come in from the CIA when he was working at Bannister's office. And there's a CIA memo that says that the agency considered using Guy Bannister for foreign intelligence work in September of 1960, but ultimately decided not to.
Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
Before we look at the potential connections between Lee Harvey Oswald and Guy Bannister, there are two incidents that happened when Oswald was in the Soviet Union that may shed light on what Guy Bannister was up to. These events are known in the JFK assassination lore as Bolton Ford and the Schlumberger Raid, also known as the Huma Raid. I've also heard people say Schlumberger, but I'm not certain, so I'm going with Schlumberger. On January 20th, 1961, the same day that John F. Kennedy was inaugurated as president, two men visited the Bolton Ford dealership in New Orleans. They spoke with assistant manager Oscar DeSlatt about buying 10 Ford Econoline trucks. The men said that they represented the Friends of Democratic Cuba. Their names were Joseph Moore and Lee Oswald. There was an information form filled out by these men, which left a paper trail. At first, Moore wrote his name, and then Oswald said that they should add his name since he was the one who was handling the payment for the trucks. Fred Sewell, who was Oscar DeSlatt's boss, also saw these men. He said that the man who went by Oswald filled out a bid form and wrote Oswald, but there was no first name. However, Sewell testified in the Clay Shaw trial that Oswald did identify himself as Lee Oswald. And Bolton Ford still had this form that said Oswald after the president was assassinated. Remember, in January of 1961, Lee Harvey Oswald was in Minsk. So we know that this cannot actually be the real Oswald. According to a November 25th, 1963 FBI report, Oscar DeSlatt said that he could not identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the man he saw. But that goes against what his boss, Fred Sewell, told Jim Garrison. Sewell positively identified Lee Harvey Oswald as one of the men who rented the vehicle. He said that DeSlatt was the one who told him about Oswald and the assassination. Sewell said, quote, "When the president was assassinated and the name came out, Oscar came in the next morning or the morning after and said, 'Say, Fred, do you remember those two guys who was in here from Cuba trying to get buses cheap?' And I said, 'Yes.' He said, 'I think that one of those men is the one who killed the president.'" So what do we know about the Friends of Democratic Cuba, and why would they need to buy 10 trucks? There's an October 26, 1967 CIA memo that says, quote, "This organization was created by several New Orleans business and political figures to collect money to aid Cubans in their fight against communism." So there you go. The Friends of Democratic Cuba is an anti-communist, anti-Castro group. But what is perhaps more interesting about the Friends of Democratic Cuba is that one of their incorporators and a member of the board of directors was Guy Bannister. Another incorporator was Gerard Tujag, who you may remember from when he briefly employed Oswald in 1955 and 1956 for his export company in New Orleans. There's also a January 24th, 1961 FBI memo that says that the Friends of Democratic Cuba, quote, "reportedly is controlled by the Frente Revolucionario Democratico, also known as FRD, an anti-Castro organization which is receiving the covert support of the CIA." So we have Lee Oswald, or someone who looks very much like him and is using his name, trying to buy trucks for an anti-Castro group in January of 1961. This is the opposite of Oswald's Marxist pro-Castro persona that he would later have, including in the summer of 1963. But that doesn't really matter because we know that this cannot be the real Oswald since he was in Minsk. The question is, why was someone using the name Lee Oswald to buy trucks for an organization whose incorporators included Guy Bannister and Oswald's old boss? According to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Guy Bannister was, quote, "implicated in a raid in late 1961 against a munitions depot in Houma, Louisiana, in which various weapons, grenades, and ammunition were stolen. Bannister's role may have been limited to storing the material, which was reportedly seen stacked in Bannister's back room by several witnesses. Bannister found out that some of the explosives that were intended to be used for the Bay of Pigs were still in storage at a French-owned business, the Schlumberger Wells Company, which was located in Houma, about an hour southwest of New Orleans. Bannister wanted to be sure that those weapons were used to fight Castro. So, according to two investigators who worked with Bannister, Jack Martin and David Lewis, Bannister traveled to Washington, D.C. and got written authority to seize the munitions at Schlumberger. Whether or not Bannister really had governmental permission, we do know that the raid on the Schlumberger munitions bunker did happen. The precise date of the raid is not exactly certain. Jim Garrison believed that it was in August of 1961, but others have reported that the raid was before the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was in April of 1961. The burglars in this infamous Houma raid were David Ferry, Gordon Novel, Sergio Arcacha Smith, and a few others. The burglars broke into the Schlumberger Munitions Company, and they took explosives and ammo. Those stolen munitions made their way to several locations, including Guy Bannister's office. According to a 1967 article in the New Orleans States Item, there were 50 to 100 crates of ammunition in Bannister's office that were labeled Schlumberger. An unnamed source told the paper that there were 5 or 6 open boxes which had rifle grenades, landmines, and little missiles that he had never seen before. Gordon Novel, one of the men who was involved in the Houma raid, was a very interesting guy who was either a con man or some sort of intelligence operative. Maybe both, depends on who you ask. Novel told the FBI in 1961 that he, his wife, 2 Cubans he didn't know, 2 ex-Marines he didn't know, Sergio Arcacha Smith, and David Ferry all carried out the bunker theft at Houma, and they did it using a laundry truck. He says that he got involved after Arcacha Smith asked him to help, and Novel claimed that the burglary was directed by the CIA. He told Jim Garrison the same thing he told the FBI, but Novel actually ended up suing Garrison for libel and lost in court after Garrison said that Novel was involved in the Houma raid. Yeah, of course Novel lost his lawsuit. He's the one who told Garrison that he was involved in the raid. But Gordon Novel wasn't the only one who said that the Houma raid was CIA-sponsored. Sergio Arcacha Smith's former lawyer, Frank Hernandez, also said that the CIA backed the raid. To be clear, the CIA expressly denied any role in the Houma raid. However, the CIA did not deny its ties to the Schlumberger Company. There's an internal CIA memo that said that the New Orleans office had one contact with Schlumberger in 1955. And after that, quote, "There has been occasional but circumspect contact with the main Schlumberger office in Houston for an extended but unspecified period. Such contact continues." In other words, the CIA is saying that they occasionally talk to them over a long period of time, and they don't want to tell us exactly when that period of time was, and they still talk to them when the memo was written. It's also worth noting that there's a potential tie between the Schlumberger Company and the French Anti-Algerian Independence Terrorist Group, OAS. OAS tried to assassinate French President Charles de Gaulle because he was going to give the Algerian people self-rule and end French colonialism. According to French Admiral Pierre Lacoste, the CIA supported the OAS in its mission to assassinate President de Gaulle. District Attorney Jim Garrison says that the CIA provided Schlumberger with arms to assist the OAS, and when the OAS was no longer operational, Bannister then made sure that the CIA's weapons were returned so that they could be used against Cuba. At the end of the day, no one was ever really held accountable for the Hoover raid. Jim Garrison tried to question Sergio Arcacha Smith in connection with it, but he wasn't able to find him in Dallas. Eventually, Garrison telegraphed an arrest warrant to Dallas for Arcacha Smith due to his role in the Hoover raid. The Dallas police arrested Smith and then released him on a $1,500 bond. But because Governor John Connally refused to sign the extradition papers within 90 days, Arcacha Smith was released from the bond and allowed to go free. Guy Bannister never faced any repercussions for receiving the stolen property, but the fact that numerous witnesses, the HSCA, and a New Orleans newspaper all say that there were stolen weapons stored at Bannister's office makes it very likely that Guy Bannister was more than just a private eye. Next time on Solving JFK, we continue looking at what witnesses said about Guy Bannister. We'll focus on whether Lee Harvey Oswald was working for Bannister, including whether Oswald was using the 544 Camp Street address. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information. I'm just